Welcome to the Academic Podcast. It is been a while. We're back from a very, very long time off. Today is the 25th of March, 2018, and I'm back for a series of podcasts this year where I'm hoping to talk to a number of people about art. What I'm really focusing on this year is the relationship between theory and practice on one hand, and also the relationship between process and results on the other hand, because this is something that I'm always wrestling with. I'm very excited about today's podcast. My guest today is someone who I've been following on Twitter for quite a while, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Okay, so my name is Katie Marie Bruce, and I am an artist and educator based in Lethbridge, Alberta. I work primarily in print media and textiles, and every so once in a while I make something that's 3D, although that's less, not happening as often as I would like to at this point in time.
It's not something you're doing at the moment.
No, it's something that I am actually, yesterday I had a mini brainstorm in my notebook about a sort of print object instead of a print, like flat print.
So 3D printing.
Mm-hmm. But, well, kind of. Thinking about, like, wanting to manipulate things with one's hands. So whenever I make something that's sculpture-based, it's always because I want the viewer to actually, like, pick it up and experience it, like, tactily. So
that's really interesting. I ought to start with, how did you evolve into print media? I'm really curious about, like, how did you get to printing and letters and folding and things like that?
Sure. So I had this friend that we had taken a number of art courses together in our undergrad. And we were kind of like, well, we've exhausted photography and we've exhausted like drawing and painting. And neither of us felt particularly inclined towards sculpture at the time. And so there was this print course and we were like, yeah, I mean, we could try that. That wouldn't be so bad. And I think probably by the third assignment, I was just like totally and 100% hooked. And even at that point in time, we weren't doing anything like what my current practice is. It was just like, here's a wooden block, you're going to carve it, you're going to apply some ink, and that's kind of going to be it. And that was
just... Is it lithograph?
No, it was just like relief printing.
Okay, I don't know any of the technical language. I'm just trying to remember what all the differences are.
For sure. So lithograph is when you are using grease to kind of like draw onto a stone, like a limestone, and then
right.
you're rolling up ink over top of that grease that kind of like sucks onto it. I mean, there's a couple of different etching processes that happen, but essentially what you've drawn becomes the image in a lithograph. Whereas the relief printing, you are carving out an object or carving out an image. And then that becomes right. sort of the matrix in which you are applying ink to. I got really interested in not using a press and not using ink at that point in time. I was really falling in love with shadows and really super subtle embossings.
Right.
So my practice consisted of embossing and embroidery for about 3 years after that, fairly solely just embroidery and embossing. And was really interested in sort of the idea of surfaces holding on to all the memory and as some kind of like an archive or a record of the work that happens over top of it. And so I was taking these found surfaces and creating an embossing, just using sort of what I could push the paper into and then embroidering right. over that like it was a found pattern.
That's really, I mean, that there is so much to unpick. I mean, I guess unpick is the word, but I mean, that it really does make sense how you've moved from that to the, you know, the printing of the letters and the folding and the unfolding.
Yeah, well, I mean,
with memory, and it was a bit about, you know, the very like the subtlety of, you know, when you crease paper and then uncrease, you know, fold it and unfold it, you know, mm-hmm. there's the very subtle shadows that result.
So maybe for anybody that's listening, my current body of work is fairly strictly about either anxiety or like these letters. And the letters are not legible. They're written on sort of both sides of the same sheet of paper. So you aren't actually able to, you can like pick out bits and pieces and maybe a fragment of a sentence here and there. But for the most part, the two letters align perfectly. And so what you have is just a crossing out of what is being written. And then to kind of further make them illegible, I'm folding the letters up. So they're these super thin pieces of, they're like a 16 gram paper if you want to get very, technical. Very light. It's so very
is
light.
That kind of like yeah. onion skin paper or like carbon, you know, like, is that like the carbon copy kind of weight of paper?
Yeah, I think you could probably compare it to a carbon copy, sort of like the top sheet, the piece that you would pull off. That would be very much similar. This is I'm working on fairly strictly like a Japanese paper, because I used to work for the Japanese paper place, which is based in or around Toronto, I suppose, and kind of like fell in love with the materiality and just how sensitive it was to different marks that had been made and being able to pick those marks up off of a plate that has gone through some sort of process-based mark making.
I guess my next question is your art, I'm struggling to try to come up with what I want to ask here, but it's, I think, you know, my basic understanding of art was on one hand, there's the creator and on the other hand, there's the audience. And I think I would like to ask you sort of what's the role or the purpose or the, I mean, how much does the audience matter in your work? I should specify, I mean, obviously you could be creator and audience.
Mm-hmm. I think the role of the audience in the letter pieces is it speaks towards kind of the, so these are letters that I'm writing to specific individuals and they're letters right. that I would never actually send as just a script. So they are either love letters or they're letters of grievance. And I think the viewer's participation in understanding that they want to feel privy to that kind of intimate moment, but then also coming up across something that they're not allowed to interact or they're not allowed to read it, there's kind of that sort of draw in and denial that reflects back into a lot of my relationships with the people that I'm writing these letters to. That sort of
right.
You've pulled me into this sort of relationship and then there's been some kind of no or there's been some kind of barrier that's been put up, whether it's an emotional barrier or a physical barrier, that prevents sort of like a free conversation to happen.
Right.
Whereas with the anxiety body of work that spans kind of these embroidered pieces as well as a lot of etchings, so a lot of printed pieces. The role of the audience is to, I guess, not, I would never wish the feelings that I have on another human being, but the idea that you could encounter something and briefly understand what that would feel like, I think that that's where the role of the audience is maybe more traditional, like you are approaching a thing and having a physical response to it. That's at least how I perceive a lot of the anxiety of work.
I can't help but think of Beethoven, you know, in his later years when he's putting, I mean, you know, looking at a piece of paper that's in a gallery setting is not quite, I mean, maybe as transient as music, but there's just for me, it's often about music with Beethoven at the end, there's just little moments where you get just a little glimpse of, you know, that moment of understanding of what he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, sometimes it wasn't easy for him to communicate. So sometimes it's confusing and lots of noise, but then there's the moments of clarity where he can communicate and there's that moment of connection with the audience.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I think a lot of artists, well, visual and musicians and,
Well, everybody, really.
Yeah, everybody. They're looking for that moment of connection, right? So I was actually talking with one of my friends, Kesha, about this, where, you know, when you're in the studio and you're making a thing, sometimes it has this ability to sort of generate other pieces from it. So you're learning through making, and there's a bodily recognition that while you are sort of drawing a thing or sculpting it with your hands, something starts to make sense. And that lets your mind sort of just like take off in this kind of tangential direction that then ends up being a different body of work or a different image or a, like an addition to what you're doing right now. And that kind of sort of perpetual making state, I would hope also sort of transcends the studio space and ends up in the gallery, where you start to understand like the key points and how they sort of grasp from one piece to another. And maybe there is a moment where the body takes on, like the viewer's body takes on this kind of alternative mode of understanding how that piece came to be, or sort of the emotions that would have gone into it.
I know you can't say it, but I'm just sitting here nodding. Because what you're saying to me speaks to me so deeply on an academic level of the way that not sometimes with my writing, when I get going and then you just go off into crazy places, into tangential places. But the way that when I'm reading something, the example that comes to mind is actually Terry Pratchett in Thud and in Feet of Clay, talking about things that are very close to what I study for my history stuff. And there's just this moment where things make sense and I want to push out and start creating things at that point. Mm-hmm. Although usually I'm on the bus, so I can't. I think anybody who does academia or any kind of creative process totally understands what you mean there.
And like, I kind of hope that, a lot of my Twitter interactions are academics, like by and large, that is kind of who I follow and who follows me back. But you know, when I've had things that have been installed in Toronto, the people that generally go out from Twitter to actually see the IRL things in real life, they're the ones that are having these real relationships, these like big blossomings of emotions in front of them. And that's really awesome to hear about, that this thing that you've been, you know, hunched over embroidering for, like a month and a half has actually like managed to bring a person to the point of tears, and not because it makes them sad, but because it's something that they understand.
The emotional throughput exceeds the current bandwidth or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to build on that because that it provides a good segue to something, but first I want to ask you about the letters themselves, if I may.
Yeah, for sure.
You said there are letters you write to people. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if sometimes you find yourself writing a letter that you didn't expect to write, or even, you know, these are letters to people, things you'd never send them, never let them read. And I was also wondering if sometimes you find yourself writing a letter and it surprises you to the point that you're not even willing to use it for your art.
Yes and no. Often when, like the one that I just finished writing is to a family member. And the things that poured out while I was writing it were kind of like, oh, okay, so we have to like make sure that these letters align because they cannot be seen.
Yeah.
So there is a sort of trusting relationship, or there are definitely points in time in which, maybe even not with the letters, but with other pieces where I've known that I have to do this thing. This image isn't going to leave me alone until it is out of me, until it is on a piece of paper, and I have put it into the world. And so even if I can't bring myself to make it at that point in time, I know that it has to happen eventually. So these letters, some of them are for individuals from like 2002, some of them are from last year. So it's really about kind of like finding the vulnerability and then trusting that it is going to feel better once it's outside.
So I know that you're in a relationship. Mm-hmm. How do you manage the sort of, you know, dealing with that kind of emotion in your work, you can't keep it boxed into your work. And so I'm wondering how you, I guess this is more of a process question, in terms of managing those emotions, in terms of steering them towards the work as much as possible, and sort of how do you deal with the excess of emotion or the other need to sort of maybe blow off steam or whatever it is outside of what you can do in your work?
Yeah, that's a really like weird space to balance for me right now, because up until maybe like the summer of 2015, a lot of my work was kind of arm's distance. Like I wasn't actually in it. It was all things kind of exterior to me. And I may be thinking about, you know, like my dad or, you know, who is a manual laborer. So like I see, every time I was seeing him at that point in time, it was like I was noticing how much his job was kind of layering on top of him.
Yeah.
So it was always kind of this like arm's distance. And now it's very, very close. So I find myself doing really strange things in the studio. Like I will just cry. And that's like, I've just accepted that like, that's going to happen sometimes. But then I will also listen to like really crude, comedian podcasts that are like super inappropriate for anybody else in that space. Just so that when I'm pulling up all of these letters and I have this stack of evidence before it becomes crossed out with the other side, so that I'm kind of like, I'm giving myself a bit of an emotional break from it, because the writing of them is emotional. And then the actual like creating the plates where you're scratching into the surface of something with such sort of aggression that you are leaving enough of a mark to print from. And then the actual, like, you ink up your whole plate, the thing that you have in front of you, like, these plates start off as 6 by 8 inches. The whole thing you cover in black ink, and then you slowly sort of, like, buff the ink just into the scratched surface. So all of a sudden these words are appearing, and you're like, fuck, I'm going to have to, like, deal with this, like, 6 more times before I can do the other side, and then I don't have to worry about reading them constantly. So yeah, my manner of balancing that out is like making sure that I have a lot of levity and laughter in my life as well.
I have to admit, that's something I have struggled to deal with in my work. It's not about anxiety, but I get very emotionally involved in, are my arguments as concise, or are they precisely what I want them to be?
Right. And like there's this weird like value proposition that gets put on the things that you put out into the world and whether or not they're true enough to be there.
And this really gets me, because I hate that my PhD thesis is now sitting in the library at school with a whole bunch of typos in it. You know what I mean? It's done,
yeah,
right?
No,
you know,
the thing is, yeah.
Apparently the best PhD is a finished PhD. And mine is finished, but I feel like I could spend 10 years working on the damn thing.
Right.
You know, just more concise, making it better. And I can't, because it's this thing that is finished.
Yeah. It exists in the world. And that's like, that was, once it was bound in a book, there it is.
And I can't, I mean, the odds are no one will ever actually read the typed up copy, like the printed copy. But what really gets me is that I'm not allowed to fix all the typos in a Word document, because it has to be, at King's, it has to be electronic as well as physical. So, I mean, most people, if they read it, will read the electronic copy. It has to be identical to the printed copy they have on the shelf. So I'm not allowed to go and fix it and then send them the corrected edition, like the corrected text without all the typos.
Yeah, that would also drive me totally, like, up the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something I'm kind of, and I talk about this a lot on Twitter, that, you know, I constantly talk about my writing on Twitter. So people know that, you know, anyone who knows me knows that my work is always in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, that I find that very frustrating. But, you know, this does provide a pretty good segue onto something I want to talk about. I mean, on Instagram, at least, if not, I think on Instagram and Twitter, I have seen that you put photos of your work at different stages. Yeah. No, fairly detailed photos. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know about scale. This is really interesting to me, considering what you've talked about how, you're trying to make this, the letters not readable, and yet at most stages, it seems like at a bunch of the stages, you do show the work that you're working on. And I was wondering about how you decide about how to show that process on social media while you work on things.
Well, I do rely on Instagram's terrible sort of pixelating, however it goes about it, to sort of make some of the things a little bit less legible. Right. But the reason that I kind of work through the whole process of here's the idea, here's me making the thing, here's me running into a mistake or a problem, overcoming it, the final piece, or however many times that sort of middle part, yeah, where there's a mistake and then I have to fix it and then go back over it before it actually becomes, yeah, a thing. And a lot of that is because I think that there's a problem with the way that sometimes we approach art as though it's come out of a vacuum. Yeah. So it's kind of two-part. It's like this worry that I don't want people to think that, oh, there was just this thing. It just happened, and now it's in the world. Like, showing the process of how a thing is made, I think, helps to bring appreciation to it. And I think print is also kind of a weird space where, it's not like a painting, so it's not, you don't understand the, I have colors, I have a paintbrush, I have a canvas or a substrate that I'm going to apply these colors to, and then at some point in time it will be done. Whereas print is very much there's a lot of chemicals involved, there's a lot of prep involved, it's very, very process orientated, and so being able to show some of that process, I think, is also an educational piece for me, where a lot, right, of the other artists that I'm following and enjoying is that they're showing this kind of these stages. And so it is very much about I think I've always been fairly devoted to process-based works. And even though these works are maybe less about setting up a task and following through until it is finished, it is still very much a labor. Yeah.
You talk about mistakes. So how do you deal with, decisions you make, creases you make, phrasing of the letter that you write when you don't like it?
So I script out the letters ahead of time. I script them out first with just kind of pen and paper. And then that way I can work through and make sure that it's actually just long enough to be on the front and the back side. And then I translate that into a Word document so that I've got, so that my spell check is maybe more correct than my initial scripting. And then, right, from there, I'm writing directly onto the plate. So with the letters and the plexiglass pieces, there's really no, once you've made a whoops in your actual writing, that's kind of, it's just there. You have to either deal with it or scratch it out, or there's no backing up. With a copper plate, there's a lot more that you can do. You can bring the edges of that copper back together again so that there is a seamlessness to it. And then as far as the creases go, I spend a long time sitting with each of the letters and kind of seeing, just sort of making gentle folds with them and finding out where the perfect amount of information is revealed and hidden, as well as making sure that I'm not making a fold that's really similar to a fold I've already made. So the creases in those are not so bad because they only get sort of permanent once I take them through a whole other process. So I can kind of, I can work with the material, and it's pretty strong for how thin it is. So I can make a crease and decide that maybe that's not quite right, and I can back it up a centimeter and see if that's better.
The comment you just made about repeating a crease, making sure you don't repeat a crease. Okay, this maybe sounds a little bit crazy, but I really like watching Project Runway.
Okay.
And so there's, you know, well, this is a chef dress that we see everywhere now. Mm-hmm. And I'm really intrigued by there's art as the almost extruded physical or creative result of emotion, which will usually be unique, or at least, no, I would stick with unique because of context and the artist and all that. But then you have, you know, people also work in the way that they work. And so they will have patterns that they do, and they have routines that they will do in their work. How do you view originality in your work when it comes to, I guess, emotion or content or process or how they all work together? Sorry, that's a little bit out of left field.
No, that's okay. I mean, at least from the emotional standpoint, these letters are coming from a very specific place inside of me, inside of my heart, yeah. I suppose, and sometimes behind my heart and sometimes just stuck in my brain. And so I know that the content at least is real and original and specific to my circumstances and specific to those other individuals and our interactions from the past. Emily Dickinson has a really beautiful sort of series of, she had written sort of poems on envelopes. And I have her book. I haven't opened it, which is these scans of the letters themselves, because I wasn't aware that they existed in the world. Until I started kind of posting these online and having people have reactions, I suppose, or bring up other things that they were kind of thinking were tangentially related. And as far as a folded print goes, I mean, it was something that there were like three or four of us at York University, where I did my master's, who were kind of all interested in like figuring out, like, how would you actually make this fold, like, happen? like, how are we going to turn the material of, like, a regular shinkale, which is just mounting this thin paper to a flat piece of heavier Western paper?
Okay.
But, like, how do you actually, what is the technical steps in order to make sure that that fold actually stays? And so, like, a couple of us kind of figured it out and then shared our findings, and now we're all using folds in very different ways, or some of us aren't using folds anymore, but whatever. But like that shared sort of knowledge bank of like, this is how we're going to do it, and it actually works, so that's great. Now everybody go and do something totally different with it. And here I found myself like working with grief and whatever else through it. So
I mean, the really bad comparison that comes to mind is doing darts. I can't remember what season what it was, but someone had a way of doing darts. And it's just, you know, if you show three people your trick for doing really good darts, fine, you'll all be doing the same way to get that shaping, but you'll do completely different things with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And our images are very different, and the source material is very different. So even if it shows up in other work, I still don't feel like it's problematic, I suppose.
Yeah, I wasn't really worried about, you know, originality and being problematic. I'm not sure that art needs to be unique to be beautiful and appreciated. You know, in history, originality is this big thing. But you also have to be part of conversations.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the whole Leibniz and Newton thing, the idea that one of them gets the credit for inventing calculus and the other one gets no credit at all.
Yeah. I have a friend, her name is Christy Kirchner, and we actually just had a show in Calgary, Alberta, where we were both dealing with folds. And her folds were very much, I mean, if you think about it, like a show about folds, like, wow, that could be really boring if it were the wrong two individuals. But I think we both have a real sensitivity to materiality, and we both came to folds in a very similar way, which was like noticing that we were keeping receipts that we would kind of like, for Christy, she would keep receipts or maps tucked in her pocket, and she would fold it as she was kind of working through her thoughts or on like in public transit or whatever. And yeah, for me, I came to folds because I used to keep a kerchief in my front pocket all the time. And then, you know, I had a really bad breakup or whatever. And then that kerchief wasn't always there. It was like at the bottom of my bag. And I started like documenting, just like finding this kerchief. And so we both kind of came to it through this like accidental thought process. And so her folds still remain very different, very beautiful, but very different from mine.
Considering we're talking about emotion and anxiety, do you think scars are an appropriate term for folds? I'm coming from the there was that image of that letter from Samuel Pepys that I showed you on Twitter a couple of days ago. You know, it's 350 years old, and it's a document that was purposely folded, you know, basically to form an envelope. The writing on the inside, the address, the contents on the inside, the address on the outside, and now it's unfolded, flat-ish, in a volume. And it's being, when I hold it in my hand, it's like the folds are to me, they're almost scars in a document.
I think it's really interesting that you brought up scars, because I used to think about scars like all the time. So maybe scars precluded folds for me. In terms of like a memory of a thing that happened, and it was like a sharp happening. It wasn't a, like there's the memory that a skin holds, where you've got like the bed sheets as being your gentlest sort of crease that your skin is going to come up against. And then the next kind of like hardest thing is going to be a bruise, which is going to be temporal, and it won't actually alter the surface of it, but it eventually goes away. But for a while, that's sort of like the memory of running into the table or the cabinet for me would be like really present in my body. And then the idea of the scar being the longest kind of memory that your body holds on to. Yeah. So I do think about scars an awful lot. So it's interesting for you to kind of tie them into folds.
When I look at your work, my mind goes off in so many different directions. Well, A, because I'm ADD. So it's going to do that anyways. It always gets tied into the arc, you know, the archival documents, which are so important to my work, because for me, they often, these documents, they were the documents I work with, for example, had definitions of what the Royal Navy was as an institution. Mm-hmm. And so they were defining things that shaped the institution, but they were often the result of bad things happening. A number of ships get lost in a storm, and they come up with new regulations for something. It's almost like the bruise of those lost ships goes away, but there is this scar left in the paperwork almost.
Right.
When I was finishing my PhD, we had this discussion about how should I talk about how I use these documents. And that was one thing I had in mind. In the end, we talked about archaeological documents and looking at the changes in the documents as archaeological remnants. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you know, as a sidetrack from there, I mean, you create your work, you mount it in a gallery, and then do you see your work when it's after the shows are finished as not relics, it's not the artifacts, that's the word I want, sort of artifacts of scars or artifacts of emotions?
Yeah, I think we could probably call them that. So there's the series, the first folded series was Within Reach, Out of Touch. And it is something that I continue to go back to. So it's not like a closed series at this point in time, but it took the same sort of dimension of my kerchief. And then I was working through all those like variable folds that sort of in half and in half once more can produce. And when I think about the original I guess, 13 of them. There is definitely some kind of, like, I can remember or I can understand where they came from initially, and then also sort of this idea of revisiting that kind of emotion. So the letters are still a little bit too fresh right now for me to feel as though they're artifacts or that they, yeah, they're still too fresh. And I'm only, like, I'll be starting letter 4 hopefully in May. I would assume that's probably the earliest I'm going to get to it. And then there will be another 5 letters after that one. So it, as an ongoing body of work, it's hard to say, yeah, that's a thing.
That's true.
But if I look back on the embroidered pieces that I was doing with the embossings, those ones feel like artifacts. They're artifacts of space. They're artifacts of a certain mindset for me. And they were all part of a show called, like, On the Principles of Nostalgia, thinking about all the places that I had lived while I lived initially in Lethbridge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they definitely do have a kind of archaeological artifact or record or a, yeah.
It was a completely random question. So I'm always fascinated by the way that people look at their work and consider their work, because I have a hard time putting things down and saying this is done. Just putting down work and walking away from it and leaving it alone and letting it become an artifact.
I think I would if I, when I was drawing and when I was painting, I had a really hard time with being like, that's it. There it is. There's the end. That's a finished piece.
Done. Yep.
But with print, for some reason, I kind of, maybe I'm embedded enough in it, or maybe I just have a, I don't know. There is something that tells me when a thing is ready to be printed in its full edition. And I'm really thankful for that, because otherwise I would go a little bit crazy, I think.
I completely understand that.
Yeah.
There was a composer, I think it may have been Mahler, who kept on working on his first symphony until he died. And he just, you know, I think it was something like 30 years. Yeah, and so he had it, you know, he finished his first symphony. It was premiered. It was performed. And even though he kept on writing other things, he kept on going back to that first symphony and rewriting it and mucking with it.
Mm.
I completely appreciate that inability to let things well enough alone. You've started teaching recently.
Yeah. I moved back to Lethbridge with the mindset that I needed to be here for the exact sort of alignment of events that led to me now being employed at the university, where, you know, sort of there's a larger body of kind of closer to retirement. So there's always a host of sort of potential medical problems. And yes. So I got a call a couple of weeks ago, and it was the head of the department, and she was like, hi, basically this situation has come up. If you can, it'd be really great if you could come in this afternoon. If not, we would accept next week as well. And
I called up.
Yeah. And it was kind of this like as soon as I, like, she sent me a Facebook message, and I don't remember ever talking to her outside of, like, when I was an undergrad. And I, like, my whole body just went into, like, a big old sweat, and I was like, this is it right now, this is happening. And so, you know, we had this conversation. I was like, I have to talk to my boss. Like, I have a regular day job. I need to find out if we can rearrange my schedule for 6 weeks so that I can have these afternoons off. And I think that made her a little bit nervous, because she was thinking, like, okay, this is a no. And it worked out. So now I am teaching printmaking at the University of Lethbridge. And I only have 2 classes left, but I'm trying not to get sad about it.
Walking into that first class, I mean, what was it like?
Well, it was, I was a huge bundle of nerves, because I haven't been in front of a class since 2015. And I was also walking into my alma mater. So there's all those kind of like really big feelings. And then it was like, okay, this is, it's go time. Like, there's no, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like, you need to show up and be here for these kids because they've had a pretty rough term. And I mean, they're not kids. They're like in their 20s. They're going through a lot right now, but like, they need a presence.
Sorry, are you teaching undergrad or are you teaching grad, like master's level?
I'm teaching an undergrad course. So this would be, some of them, this is their first interaction with print, and some of them have taken one other course previous to it. But they're a really good group, and I feel very lucky to have a number of them are in there, and they're doing wonderful work. So, yeah.
How does it feel to be teaching art or teaching printmaking as well as, you know, working with print creatively yourself? I guess what I'm really trying to ask here is about theory versus practice.
Right.
Because that's always a fascinating thing for me.
Mm-hmm. So working with these students, it's been really great because they're kind of thirsty for knowledge. They were running into a couple technical problems previous to my arrival, and they didn't have the resources to kind of like figure out what was going wrong. So now I get to be in this position where I'm witnessing them get it right, and the same kind of like exuberant joy that I feel when the first print rolls up and it's just what I need it to be, I'm now witnessing that in other people. So I'm kind of getting this like reverberation, this really wonderful echo feeling that goes on. So yeah, like, it's been hard to navigate being in the studio and also teaching and working, because there's a limited number of days, or limited number of hours in a day, and I am kind of butting up against my maximum as far as taking care of myself, but then also doing these jobs. I haven't been making as much as I would normally, but I think if I was in a position where teaching was my day job, like if that was the thing I was doing, I would still be able to find a way, because I'm getting all these echoes of their joy finding out that they're making a thing the way they hoped it would, or better than, or there's something that's magical happening and they weren't aware that that was going to happen, and it did, and it's great. There would always be that kind of like pull to to find that for myself.
When I was TAing undergrad history, it was when the students had the good discussions. You know, when we had a good seminar, I used to teach two seminars back to back Friday morning. When both classes had a good discussion, all I wanted to do afterwards was find my friends and head to the pub and you know, have 7 or 8 pints and argue stuff for 6 hours. Just because that energy, it's an amazing feeling for that. I am curious about sort of the physical aspects of being in the studio. Is there sort of an energy difference? Sounds weird, but is there a sort of palpable difference between the comfort level of being in your studio, in your studio, versus being in the studio at the school?
I'm still, every time I step into that classroom right now, I'm still really nervous. And I think it's like, a lot of it is, you know, I've made a lesson plan up. I have things I want to accomplish today, and I really hope I get to all of them without forgetting one of them. And so there's still kind of the like nervous energy of being in there. And it's also a totally different studio from when the first time was that I was printing in there. So there's like a, not quite a familiarity there for me yet, as far as knowing what things are.
It's not the same studio as when you were there.
No, they renovated, I think, like 1 or 2 years after I graduated. So it is still the same like physical room, but things have moved and there are separate kind of like areas for different things now. And yeah, so it's very different. And then when I walk into the studio that I kind of work in for my own reasons, I know where everything is and I have this sort of like really easy flow that happens once I get in there. So they're very different energies as far as the classroom studio versus my working studio.
Oh, that's really interesting. I think we've had a very wide-ranging discussion, which is, I mean, we could keep going I'm sure for quite a bit longer, but I think this is a good place for now. Maybe we could do this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would really enjoy that. At this point, I always provide my lovely guests with an opportunity to talk about their projects. So what do you have going on that you'd like to promote?
Well, I mean, I've got some long-term pieces. So I have a solo show next January here in Lethbridge, which I'm hoping I can find other venues for. And then I've also got a residency on the East Coast in St. John's sometime that fall.
Awesome.
Yeah. So those are my two big, like, woohoos kind of on my horizon. And then otherwise, you can find me at KMB_artist on Twitter and on Instagram.
I'm sure a bunch of people will be doing just that. I'd like to thank Katie Marie Bruce for being so lovely, especially with my fumbling over trying to talk about art.
You did great. Hush.
I feel much better now. And we look forward to continuing these conversations in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, me too. Thank you so much